Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. You know, I get a lot of books sent to me as the host of the show, and many of them recently have dealt with the Apollo missions to the moon that took place 50 years ago. As a history and photography buff myself, the book Picturing Apollo 11 by John Bisney and J.L. Pickering really struck a chord with me. It's a classic coffee table picture book filled with lush, beautifully reproduced photographs that detail from start to finish the first lunar landing mission that took place in July of 1969. But what makes the book so special is that most of the photographs have never been reproduced in a book before. Coupled with the expert analytic captions and text of veteran radio journalist John Bisney, the photography collection collected and curated by J.L. Pickering makes for an amazing visual time capsule into one of the greatest adventures in history. I shared the book recently with a young college student and was amazed to watch him pore over the photographs for 3 hours as he turned the pages slowly while savoring each moment. That was the same experience that I had, but since I'm a connoisseur of all things Project Apollo, it was fascinating to me to see someone who was born decades after the mission became as enthralled as I had. So we have the creators of Picturing Apollo 11 joining us for this program via Skype. John Bisney and J.L. Pickering, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I have to say, you know, when I first saw this book, on Amazon or some wherever I saw it, it was like, okay, here's another 50th anniversary book coming out. But then I started to hear from some friends of mine that this was a really beautiful and unusual book, so I checked it out and I fell in love with it. It's just such a beautiful book, and there's so many photographs that I'd never seen before. So I would like you both to start out by telling us, what was the genesis of this project? What got you deciding to do this book, and why is it so unique?
Well, I'll give you a little bit of background on what we do as co-authors, then maybe JL can talk about this specific project. But we've been friends for, more than 20 years now. And we're both space enthusiasts. We're both baby boomers, essentially, that grew up with the space program. But we noticed that if you go into a library or a bookstore and you pull out a book and you thumb through it about space exploration, you're typically seeing the same, 50, 60, 100 pictures over and over and over again, which is understandable because they're the greatest hits. And, of course, if you're an author, you want those in your books. But JL, and he can talk more about this, has assembled what is, I think, is the world's biggest archive of still photographs of the U.S. manned spaceflight program. And we thought, wait a minute, let's do a book of pictures that people haven't seen before. So that was the foundation of what we do. Our first book was on Mercury and Gemini. The second one was on Apollo, Skylab, and ASTP. And the third one, it was on President Kennedy in the space program. And in each of those, our goal was to show you pictures you hadn't seen before. So, Dave, you hit it right on the nose.
Yeah, and I'm one of those people that have looked through all of those kinds of books, and I've seen all the same photographs over and over again. So this was really a delight for me. And JL, something you want to add to that?
Well, it's great to hear you say all that, because that means we hit a home run with this book. After going to the archives consistently for the last 4 or 5 years, and we had the other two books done, I started to hit on a lot of Apollo 11 stuff. And I had told John at that point, I said, maybe we got enough material here. I think we could probably put another book together just on Apollo 11. And sure enough,
for the anniversary.
That's right. That's right. That was kind of the driving force, I think. The biggest problem was trying to find a publisher fast enough that we could get this put together and get it released in time. And everything fell together just right. So it's just a matter of having an abundance of material that I knew people had not seen, and putting it all together in a nice little package that that folks would enjoy, and people like yourself could really take a look at it and realize that there's some new stuff here.
Well, I'm going to give you like my ultimate compliment, because when you hear about somebody, they pick up a book and they say, oh, I can't put it down, I had to read it. This was the opposite for me. I had to keep putting it down. I would only look at a couple of pages at a time because I was enjoying it so much that it was like, oh no, I don't want to just look at this from beginning to end. I just want to linger here with these few pages. And then I'd put it down, and then the next day I'd look at a couple more, and it was just a great experience.
And I do the same thing. I pick it up every once in a while too, and I go, you know, this is pretty cool, isn't it? It really is nice. So,
well, let's talk about the structure of the book. You know, we're talking about a photography book. We're talking about pictures on the radio. What I'd be interested in, though, is like, how did you go about deciding, okay, how are we going to put the structure of this together and decide what pictures to use? Because, you know, that must have been difficult to figure out, okay, what are we going to use and what are we going to leave out? And did you have any arguments about that where you went toe to toe? It was like, no, this one's got to go in or anything like that?
I think it was pretty collaborative, but yeah, I mean, that was obviously something we talked about quite a bit. And our approach was just strictly chronological. We thought that made the most sense, which is exactly what we do in terms of what part of the hardware and what people arrived when, and it's all in the right order there. But in terms of selecting the photos, I mean, JL is the photo maestro here, and typically he would come up with, you know, 20 or 30 pictures, and then we'd start narrowing those down between us. And it wasn't so much that we'd have arguments about which one to use. It was that often JL would surprise me during the process of the book. He'd say, oh my gosh, I just got this new picture in from the archives, and this is the first color picture of something happening I've ever seen. So we're going to substitute that for the black and white.
Yeah, there was a fair amount of substitutions that would take place during the process of putting things together, because I think we had it pretty well laid out 6 months before we were done, or, you know, before we really needed to have it done. And I would keep coming up with new finds that I would sub at the last minute. And exactly as John says, I go, I got a color version, you know, we got to use the color version. I've never seen one before. So the timing was really great for getting a lot of neat stuff in at the last minute. And as far as choice of photos, John will always tell me, well, you got to, there's too many Saturn V pictures here. he's always reminding me there's too many Saturn V pictures. But I'm telling you, I know what people like to look at, and they like to look at the big rocket. So we have plenty of Saturn V shots.
Well, and it is a magnificent beast. And it's hard for people to get a sense today of the scale of that rocket and how mighty it was. Being there in the late 1960s as a child, visiting the Kennedy Space Center, which was just called Cape Canaveral when I was there, the scale of the buildings and everything, it just struck you as this is something just overwhelming, you know, as a 7-year-old seeing the size of things. And I love the pictures that you have of it. Can you talk about some of the wonderful pictures of, you know, how these giant pieces of rocket got there, and how they arrived and how they were assembled? Because I found that part of the book really fascinating to look at.
I'll make some preliminary comments, and okay, JL can talk specifics about that. But yes, you're quite right. I think about that a lot, the scale of what went on. And not only the hardware involved, but the facilities used to create that hardware. Everything had to be built essentially from scratch. And the coordination that was involved, there were, you know, maybe 10 or a dozen prime contractors, and there were maybe 80 or 100 subcontractors in every state in the country. And imagine this without the internet, without email, without modern day computing. A lot of this was done on fax machine, on carbon paper, on typewriters. And the concept that they managed to coordinate all this among them and have everything fit together and function properly, it is a complete mind blow to me.
You said it very well there. I was just going to talk about the photos a little bit. That aspect of these missions, not only Apollo 11, really all the early manned missions, the ground aspect, what happened in the processing, all that sort of thing has always interested me actually more than the flights themselves. So it wasn't hard for me at all to really go the extra mile to find the right photos of that.
JL, tell us a bit about like some of the a lot of our listeners may not be aware of this. Tell us about how they got these huge pieces of the Saturn V rocket from where they were constructed to the Kennedy Space Center and ultimately to the Vehicle Assembly Building, because it's pretty interesting how that stuff got there.
Absolutely. The first stage would be shipped in on barge. The second stage was it flown in, John? I'm trying to think.
Also barge.
So that was the third stage was flown in on the
Super Guppy.
The Super Guppy, yeah. And the spacecraft were also flown in. So, but they were all part. They would barge them in right there at the VAB, and then transport them in. Very touch and go. I mean, and then bring them into the VAB, and it was the spacecraft would end up over in another part of the Cape to be processed, and eventually brought over to the VAB as well. Then it all came together in a relatively short amount of time once everything was ready to go. The thing that I have more people question and are surprised to hear is the fact that they were out on the launch pad for so long before the actual launch.
Yeah, I was too. I really, you know, it's amazing to think that rocket sitting out in the elements, it sat out there a long time. Tell us about how long it sat out there.
Well, Apollo 11 was only out on the pad for a little less than two months. But as they went further along in the program, Apollo 17, they would be out there for 3 to 6 months during the later part of the program. So yeah, you're right. I think people got used to watching the Apollo 13 movie where the Saturn V rolled out a couple days before the launch. Yeah. I think that was kind of a, you know, art became history with a lot of people there, and they just assumed that that's the way it was. So when they see some reference to this vehicle being out there for 2 months, it's like, you're kidding me, just like you said, with all the elements and everything. But it did quite well out there.
And one of my favorite photographs, there's a lot of them, you brought it to mind, is there's a picture in the book by a photographer in the very top of the VAB, which is just like one of the largest buildings in the world. And you really do. I mean, it's almost, you get vertigo just looking at it, looking down on the Apollo 11 spacecraft from way up there at the top. That picture just blew my mind.
That's the one where they're getting ready to raise it up, and you can see the wires and everything going down, the cables and everything going down to the floor. I totally agree. And we have been in the VAB, and we have been up there on the top, and it is very scary.
It is very scary. That's right.
To look down, yeah, by the rails. So.
As I recall from being a kid and going on the tour, they said something like you could take the Empire State Building, cut it in half so it wasn't so tall. You could fit 4 Empire State Buildings inside the VAB.
That sounds about right. Yeah,
that's about right too. I always took away on those tours when the tour guide would tell you when the conditions were right, it could form its own weather inside. And I've never really been able to confirm that or not, but I always remember that about the tours.
Yeah, there was concern with that. There would be condensation and stuff, sort of mini clouds that would form at the top, and they'd have to, deal with that.
We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue our conversation with John Bisney and J.L. Pickering about their new photography book, Picturing Apollo 11. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot.
Thank you.
And we're back. And thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue our visit now with John Bisney and J.L. Pickering. Their new book, Picturing Apollo 11, features never-before-seen photographs from the preparation to the aftermath of the first lunar landing in July of 1969. I'll tell you my favorite two pictures right now. One happens right away. It's the picture for the foreword that was, I believe it was foreword written by Rick Armstrong. It's he and Mark as children and Jan Armstrong on a Life magazine boat as they're just kind of hanging on to each other, watching the launch of their father and husband. That's a beautiful picture.
Yeah, Life magazine photographers did a fantastic job. We used a couple of photos that were not NASA or not from our first-hand contacts, and that's one of them, but it was a perfect match for Rick in his foreword.
Well, sorry to disappoint you that I liked the Life magazine.
No, it's fine. It's in the book.
The other one, though, is just it's just a picture of Neil Armstrong in a white Manlon shirt with his sunglasses on. It's just a beautiful photograph of that, you know, American icon in the prime of his life. And it's just a lovely portrait of him.
Oh, that's great. That's great. The only pictures that I'm still searching for, I'm sorry, I've not located them yet, is the launch day. Launch day prints for Apollo 11, really any of the Apollo flights, are missing. Nobody knows where they are.
This is a crazy thing, Dave, and won't be the first to hear it, but you may be fascinated by this. Go ahead, JL.
The public affairs images are all there, but the Kennedy Space Center archives have been transferred to the National Archives, and they know the KSC material front and backwards. And there's the launch day images that show the crew, the launch itself, are nowhere to be found. The press site images are there, the VIP images are there, some aerial shots of the area are there, but the crew activity is not there. So,
do you have any kind of hypothesis as to why that might be? What happened to them?
Not yet. Some of the old hands at the Cape are very frustrated that I can't locate this stuff because the people that were there back in the day are not there now. But they stay in touch with a lot of people that are working there now. And they still don't know where they are. They all swear they sent them. They remember them. They remember what kind of files and envelopes and sort of things they were. They remember all that sort of thing, but yet nobody knows where they ended up. So
they could be in a garage somewhere.
We hope not.
I do talk about it in the book. I did visit with an old Technicolor photographer a couple of years ago who'd been retired for 20 years, probably 15, 20 years at least. And he had some negatives that I picked up from him. And I got home and started looking at him, and I said, you know, these are 35 millimeter negative strips of Apollo 11 in the crew during the final test up in the white room. I said, these should not have ended up at this guy's house. So, I mean, I'm going to get them back to the archives, but just that incident makes you think, does that mean somebody accidentally, I don't know if you just accidentally take those home or not, but so either they are with somebody or they're in some box somewhere that didn't get labeled right. And somebody tried to, be super protective with them and then forgot where they put them. So, you know how that goes.
Wow.
So I don't know, maybe we'll find them somewhere at some point, but fortunately we have some friends who were private photographers that were able to, supplement that launch day chapter.
Right.
And bring and make it look good too. So you probably wouldn't even know if I hadn't brought it up.
No, and I do remember reading about that previously and in your book. Tell us about some of those other sources you found for, is it the Tizu? How do you pronounce that? News Service Photography?
Yeah, Tizu. That was Jacques. Jacques passed away a couple of years ago, but Jacques was one of these guys who was there from, I would say, about halfway through the Mercury program. He would come over and cover most of the early shots.
From France.
and he finally moved over here to Florida in 71. But he put together quite a collection. He had all these photos and slides and what have you. And I'd always heard of him, and John kind of knew him. And so one time, John was living in Washington. This is back about 10 years ago. So we decided we'd go see Jacques. We called him up. He was glad to have us come over. And we made it into his basement where all of his archives are. And I started opening, going through some of these drawers and things that he had. And I'm going, oh, my God, these slides are phenomenal. And they'd never been touched probably since, you know, the 80s at the early. So they've been sitting there dormant for 30 years. And we got to know him very well. And he trusted us and trusted me. And eventually I was taking 1,000 slides home with me on a trip and scanning them all and bringing them back. So I've got quite a backlog of Tzu imagery from other flights as well.
But, and the thing about Tzu, Dave, is he was something of an artist. He was an illustrator by trade initially, but he had the right eye. So while we notice that a lot of NASA stuff often, you know, is fine, but it's a little cold and antiseptic, Tzu gives you often that human touch or that interesting angle that the NASA guys wouldn't have done.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, he's an actual photographer artist instead of just a documentarian.
Yep. Right. He didn't do this for Apollo 11, but for, I would think, 14 through 17, he would ride on the crawler during the rollout. So he was all over that tower taking pictures of the Saturn and from top to bottom. So that's what sometimes I wish I'd like to be able to say we could do a picture in Apollo, you know, 17, 15, whatever. So if we get to do that, I'm ready. So.
Well, maybe at least do 17 to do the bookends.
You're not the first to suggest that, and we'd certainly be up for it.
Well, I would certainly be up for leafing through it. So I have to ask you maybe an impossible question. Can you tell us what are your favorite photographs in the book?
Well, I knew you were going to ask me that. So I leafed through it this afternoon, and my answer is that we talked about this briefly earlier. I'm fascinated by the pictures of the Saturn stages inside the VAB as they're being assembled. And the reason is because the lighting is good, you're up close to them, you can see so much detail, and it's a very intimate experience that you just don't have, because you're seeing them from different angles. You know, there's the top and there's the bottom and what looks like this way, and it's a whole different perspective than seeing the stages assembled, you know, vertically on the pad. So that has a lot of appeal to me, all the little details of that.
And to think about all of the people working, you know, around the clock, the thousands of human hours, just the industry of it, you know, comes across in those photographs too.
I would pick the night shots of the Saturn on the pad. Always been a big fan of that. It's such a beautiful sight. I never got to see a Saturn V at night, but I've seen plenty of shuttles up close at night. And these machines are alive. I mean, you can hear the humming, I can't imagine what it was like being right up there with the Saturn V at night.
And those big xenon floodlights.
Oh, yeah. You see it for miles.
And once you got fuel in there, then it's starting to vent and, you know, adds to the drama.
And like you said, and I can recall Gene Cernan, you know, saying when I talked to him a few years ago about, you know, that vehicle was alive. It was not an inanimate object to him.
Perfect.
And another favorite photograph, and this kind of is telling, when you know the meaning of all this is we celebrate 50 years ago and the flights of Apollo. And we've tried to do an episode on each one. We just about wrapped up our Apollo 10 tribute. 50 years ago was such a different time, and there's one photograph that struck me as really kind of took me back to that time. Is there's a photograph of some people watching the launch in near the VAB, the vehicle assembly building there, and Apollo 11's lifting off. One guy's got an American flag and he's waving it, and another man's got his arms outstretched, and you just feel the pride and patriotism in that photograph. It's just very emotional in that picture.
Yeah, that's another Jacques picture. That's a very, you're right, very patriotic photo. And also a photo that every time I look at it, it's kind of an optical illusion. it looks like the launch pad is a half a mile away from these guys or these people waving the flag. So when in reality, they're what, John?
Three and a half,
4 miles away. So, but yeah, that is a good picture.
And Dave, you know, you identified something there that I think is very significant, which is, you know, let's say that we did not have a space race with the Soviet Union at the time, but we were launching the first people to go to the moon. That in itself would be an astonishing thing. So then you overlay on top of that the space race, and that's where I think you get those goosebumps.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and there was just a tremendous feeling of patriotism in a time when the Vietnam War is raging and the country was very divided. You know, we have to remember that this was a country that definitely had a generational divide and a cultural divide about the war and the civil rights movement. But for that, you know, brief shining moment there in July of 1969, everybody was pretty much just, you know, enthralled with what was going on. There's even some photographs I think you have in there of the Reverend Ralph Abernathy and his group visiting the Cape. Could you talk about that a little bit? Because that was kind of interesting.
Wow, that was, if I recall, I don't think they came there to make trouble. They were just making a point about too much money spent on space and not enough on, I'm trying to recall what a few of the signs.
Yeah, that's basically it. It was part of the Poor People's March, and they were just objecting to the level of funding. But it's a great story because they showed up, what was it, a couple of days before the launch, actually, JL?
Right.
So they went to the visitor center and they thought, well, the visitor center is pretty cool. And so the center director came out and met with them and said, look, here's, you know, 20 passes to come to the VIP site to see the launch the next day.
And
they did. And they were, and Al Abernathy says, wow, this is great.
They kind of flipped the switch on totally around. I do remember reading something about that visit though, where a lot of the tourists who saw this going on, not Payne, mainly, they were just the Abernathy and his group there, kind of looked at it as being kind of a sideshow that was going on. They weren't taking it too seriously at all. It's almost like the photographers that took the pictures were the only ones that were really paying attention to this little event going on the side here at the visitor center. But yeah, I thought those pictures needed to be in there. I thought it was a nice.
It puts it in historical and social context.
It sure does. So, and especially I like the picture of Abernathy when he's posing, looking inside the Mercury spacecraft. So
yeah, you can tell he's enjoying himself.
Right. He kind of turned tourist himself and got into the mood.
Oh, speaking of tourist, there was something that struck me as I just thought was fun is there's a few pictures in there of there was the mock-up of the lunar module there at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Center. And people love to, you know, take pictures of their families with it. And it was so striking to me seeing pictures of people taking pictures of their family thing. This is pre-selfie. You couldn't do a selfie back then.
Absolutely. Nowadays they'd be falling off the ladder. They'd be climbing up on top of it and falling off.
Well, I'm sure they do. Yeah. So I thought that was kind of fun.
Yeah.
So when you were going through all of these archives, I'm curious as to what was the, how did you first get interested in this? What was it that all of a sudden got you especially into collecting photographs and starting to archive them? When did that bug bite you? And what was it that caused that?
As crazy as it sounds, what really got me interested in the program was the Apollo fire. I'm not really sure why. That's kind of odd. I was, I would have been 9 years old, I guess. So I think it just impressed me in a certain way. And I didn't really get my hands on an 8x10 print, and probably until 71 or 72, there were some local tourist magazines in the Cape area that would come out monthly, and they used to have some really nice photo spreads in them on what was going on with the Apollo program and the upcoming missions. So I started to write these people and ask them if I could have the photos when they were through with them. And so they would send them to me. And so that was really the start. And then I just started, you know, it's a lot of letter writing. It's a lot of, eventually it's a lot of meeting the right people then. And then there's a lot of auctions. There's a lot of, other friends that collect photos. You get the idea, though. One thing leads to another, and
it becomes an obsession.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, I've probably got 20 four-door file cabinets full of prints, and then another probably 50,000 color transparencies, the large 4x5 transparencies, and then another, you know, couple 300,000 digital files. So there was a point where as a photo collector, you have to realize that there's a lot of stuff out there that is never going to be printed on paper. So you have to just accept that the digital file is just as good. So, but it's almost a full-time job keeping things organized. So
how many photographs do you have?
Hard prints, I would say 140,000 right in there. And they're all in books and organized. But that's what I mean. If you pick up a decent collection, then you have to go in and, you know, you file everything away. And I even go as far as to make sure I'm maintaining the best copy. If I have duplicates of stuff, I go in to make sure that I'm not, you know, going to give away or get rid of the better copy. So you got to do that too.
And as a result of this, Dave, you can show him a picture of any Saturn V launch from any angle, and he'll be able to tell you within about 10 seconds what it is.
Pretty much, yeah.
Wow. And I was going to say, you know, there's worse things to be obsessed by than history.
That's true. That's true. And I'll find a home for it all someday.
And what do you do to preserve all of it? Because, you know, photographs, you know, they need to be preserved. What do you do to make sure that they're properly cared for?
Well, they're all in nice sleeves. They're all in my basement, which is nice and dry and cool. So, you know, I don't know what else more I could do on a private level. But a lot of these photos are in a lot better place than they were from where I got them. Let's put it that way.
That's so right.
What are some of the most unusual places where you've gotten some photographs from? Can you tell us maybe a story about that?
A lot of them come from Florida. And, of course, there they could be out in a shed in the backyard. And you got to brush the bugs off and things like that. Unfortunately, we've seen a lot of stuff that was nicely signed that's been on the wall, and it doesn't last long in Florida. It changes about three different shades, but nothing. It's usually just stuff packed away, and it's usually in a hot room. It's never ideally stored as far as that. But
you sort of get used to that vinegary smell.
Yeah, that's right. Especially the early prints, they tend to break down the chemical smell that's on them.
And John, what first got you interested in this kind of project?
As I say, I'm a baby boomer, and when I was a boy, why, the Mercury astronauts were, of course, national heroes and in the news, and they were the big deal. And I just got hooked and grew up with the program. And then in 1964, we were fortunate. My family and I moved to the west coast of Florida, which was just when Gemini was getting going. So I demanded my parents take me over to the east coast to the Space Center between Gemini missions, actually. I didn't get to see a Gemini launch, but that was fantastic. And then, of course, very intently followed the Apollo program. And then I became a news reporter myself. And when the shuttle program began, I said, well, that's for me. And the company I was working for at the time, RKO Radio, said, well, that's terrific. You can be our space guy. So I covered the shuttle program for almost 30 years. So it's just been a lifelong fascination.
You are listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. After a short break, we'll get back to our visit with the authors of Picturing Apollo 11, John Bisney and J.L. Pickering. Stay with us. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot, and thanks for doing that. Let's get back now to our conversation with J.L. Pickering and John Bisney, author editors of the book featuring many never-before-published photographs picturing Apollo 11. Now that we're at 50 years from Apollo 11 coming up in July, what do you think is the legacy of the space race and that achieving Kennedy's goal of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to Earth all those many years ago now?
Go ahead, John. That sounds like your kind of question. It's got Kennedy in it. It's for you.
Well, it certainly demonstrates very clearly what we can do as a country on a deadline if we get our act together and pull together and exploit all the brains and resources that we have. Look at what we can do. And you know, I sometimes wonder in this divided political age of ours what it would take to bring people together on a project of that magnitude again. You know, right now, of course, we need huge expenditures on infrastructure for the benefit of everyone. But is that going to get done in this partisan environment? Something as basic as that? I don't know. So I suppose it might take something as, you know, China's going to go to Mars that would get us excited again to that level. But it certainly is a shame, I think, that nothing's come along to challenge us quite in that way since that's produced such a remarkable achievement.
Yeah, it was just a magnificent blend of men and machinery and what we could do, like John said, on in a short amount of time. And it's something that everyone is forever proud of. And it was sad to see so many people get blasé about it so soon after the event. But when to this day, when people talk about NASA, that's what they think about are the Apollo years. I personally don't get that excited about things that go on these days. I'm still captivated by these early missions. I just things like the ISS and
yeah, it doesn't have that sense of adventure and epicness to it, even though it is amazing and it's wonderful in its own right. And if you talk to somebody like Chris Hadfield, you know, about what that experience is like of living on the ISS and watching the Earth go by on a daily basis, it is inspiring. But it's not the same thing as when we went to the moon, and it was so very dangerous, is what, you know, my big takeaway is as I get older and look back on those years, is you referenced the Apollo 1 fire, and I don't think that's strange at all, because it affected me the same way. I was only 7 when I visited the Cape, and it was just a few months after the fire, and it was palpable that something terrible had happened there, and I was aware of it. And I knew that, you know, this was serious and very dangerous stuff these guys were doing.
No, that's exactly right.
But, and of course, you know, the part of the success of it, what made it so relatively safe, was the dedication of the individual people. I mean, there was something called the Manned Flight Awareness Program, where posters were put up and the astronauts would visit the contractors and hand out stickers and so forth and say, look, this, my life is on the line here. You need to know, look in my eyes and know who I am. Mm-hmm. And man rating all this stuff. I mean, wow, they did a terrific, terrific job.
Yeah, you can only put so many backups to a mission.
Yeah, I was talking to Tom Stafford yesterday, as a matter of fact, and he was talking about they had these Snoopy Awards that they would give out to the contractors, you know, for their good quality work and stuff. And then that was kind of the inspiration for, well, let's call the LEM Snoopy, and, you know, let's honor our Snoopy Award program by calling the LEM Snoopy. And then, of course, Charlie Brown was the command module for Apollo 10. And then I recall there was all this talk about, well, we need more serious names like, you know, Columbia and Eagle. But for a kid, you know, back then, when you named spacecraft Charlie Brown and Snoopy, you definitely got my attention.
Right. Gumdrop and Spider probably didn't work either for you or for.
Well, they look like Gumdrop and Spider, at least.
That's right.
Well, who's the target audience? Who do you really want to have this book in their hands? Because I think everybody would enjoy looking at it. But have you had the experience of, like, you know, having somebody that's not aware of of the Apollo program much at all, and like letting them look through it and see the fascination unfold?
I have to admit, Dave, I have not. I've spoken to friends and people about my advancing age, and they look at it with a lot of nostalgia. But yeah, you're right. I sure hope our target audience is bigger than that, and it should be. Anybody who's interested in history, in the history of spaceflight, and for sure the younger generation, as much as it pains me to say that, may not appreciate the magnitude of this undertaking. In most history books that are available, I suppose, at the junior high and high school level these days, Apollo 11, what do you think it gets? Half a page?
Not even that. Not even that.
So for them to have this as a visual resource to better understand the intricacies and the magnitude of it. I think that's a great goal.
Yeah, I was talking to a history teacher, a high school history teacher, the other day, and I said, it just seems to me that if I were teaching U.S. history and the Cold War and all of that, the best way to hook kids in and fascinate them would be to wrap that unit around the space race, because it is really interesting.
Oh, it's fascinating. And I think that today a lot of the people in school see that as history. Oh, yeah, well, we built a rocket and went to the moon, move on. Well, you try doing that.
Right. Yeah. And they become blasé because of the current state of the program for the most part. Although a lot of people are excited about, I do see a lot of excitement with the whole SpaceX
True.
System. So that's a good sign there.
I was talking to a young man. We had had shared some films with some of my classes. We watched The Right Stuff, and we also watched Hidden Figures, and we also watched an episode of From the Earth to the Moon. And he wrote something quite beautiful. He said, I never realized, that the astronauts back then were as big or bigger than pop stars and athletes are now. I had no idea. I had no idea that it was like that. And I read that and I just smiled as I thought, yep, they sure were.
That is so true, isn't it?
Yeah. Everybody knew who John Glenn was.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I always say, if somebody now in the last few years, they would say, astronaut so-and-so is going to be, over at the Science Center or something. And I said, I'm really not that interested. If it was one of the Apollo guys, yeah, I'd be there in a minute. But and I'm not trying to downplay the new astronauts that much, but they don't have the allure to me.
No, those guys were the rock stars. And, unfortunately, they are aging, and like our greatest generation of World War II veterans, we've just very few of them left. We're losing them. And it's why books like this, like this book in particular, gives you this beautiful look back into that special time of 1969. And it's gorgeous. The colors in it, it's so beautifully produced. And I just want to thank you for sharing it with all of us.
Well, speaking of the color, we have JL has a surprise for you, Dave.
Oh, okay.
I almost forgot. It was the... this is Blue Dot, right?
Yes.
Yes, and I was going to remind you that there was a nice blue dot that went off on the main panel of the LEM when it touched down on the moon.
Oh yeah, the contact light.
That's right. That's right.
Lit up blue.
That's right. That's quite appropriate. So we'll dedicate all of our Apollo shows, and this one included, to that blue dot that said, contact light. And then turn off those engines and fall those last few feet to the moon. And then the adventure really begins.
That's right. That's right.
Well, thank you so much, gentlemen, for sharing this this adventure of putting this book together with us. And I really thoroughly enjoyed it. Like I said, I savored every page. So many beautiful photographs, so many interesting ones. Oh, one thing I do want to mention before we let you go. You had one of my favorite characters of the Apollo program featured quite prominently, a guy that's in the white room. You want to talk about him real quick?
Oh, Gunter?
Yeah, Gunter Wendt. I wonder where Gunter Wendt. Tell us about him.
Gunter was around from day one. and almost lost his job at the end of the Gemini program, and then they had the fire and they called him back in. But he's quite a fixture, you're right, among people and followers of the program across the board. I'm not really sure if he was revered quite as much by the people he worked with. I think a lot of the workers thought that Gunnar got a little too much attention or a little too much credit for things that he did. But,
well, of course, he was known as the Pad Fuhrer. So, I mean, yeah. He ruled with an iron hand, and then he had that bow tie and those black glasses. So when you'd see the TV coverage, you know, as they put the people in the spacecraft, Gunnar became pretty well known.
Yes, he sure did.
Yeah, what I found fascinating about that, aside from Gunter's reputation or whatever, was, you know, the thought of those last few moments of putting the astronauts into the spacecraft and sealing that hatch and then leaving, you know, that always struck me as just such a dramatic moment in any space flight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no question. And then either in Gemini the erector would come down, or in Apollo the swimming arm would come back, and there you are looking up at the sky.
Yeah. And so, did either of you ever get to see a Saturn V launch?
Yes, I was fortunate enough to. I actually saw Apollo 8 launch from my backyard over here on the west coast of Florida. Believe it or not, it was a beautiful, clear day, and you could see it as a bright dot in the sky. But that wasn't good enough, so I was at the south gate of the Cape for Apollo 11, and I met President Nixon at the Apollo 12 launch, and then I was at the launches for 13, 15, 16, 17, and the Skylab program.
Okay, so you have experienced that. And tell us what it's like, because the Saturn V is something you don't see, you experience. Could you just share with us what it was like when that giant rocket took off?
Sure, and JL was there for a Saturn 1B launch, the Apollo Soyuz test program. But the Saturn V, boy, you know, the thing took off, and then of course there was a time delay for the sound to come across the Banana River, and hit you, and it did hit you because it's a loud snapping, crackling, popping noise, but it reverberates. It's so powerful, the sound waves, they reverberate and hit your chest. And you feel like somebody's gently sort of, you know, hitting you on the front of your chest repeatedly as these sound waves crackle through your ears. And in the meantime, you're watching this huge bright light at the base of the Saturn, which was took off more slowly than the shuttle. So it was more majestic. I mean, that's the best description I can give for you in a nutshell.
Wow.
I never saw a Saturn V launch, but I did go to Gunnar Wendt's house a couple times.
I'm sorry, that's hilarious. That's kind of like I did go to a Holiday Inn.
That's right. Yeah. I knew that. That's what I was thinking too. I did get to see Apollo 14 and 16 up close during tours, but yeah, I never got to see a launch. So unfortunately, and John's right. I did see the final Saturn, the final Apollo, the Apollo Soyuz launch. I was I just graduated from high school, and hopped in the car and drove down to the Cape. I had I was working part time at the local newspaper, and I used their letterhead to apply for press credentials. And I got press credentials and went down and spent the week waiting for the launch and watching the launch, and then drove to Houston, used the press credentials down there to kind of see what was going on down there. So that was pretty good, pretty cool for a 17-year-old.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, on that note, we're going to let you go. It is interesting to think back about all those many years ago, that flight in particular, where we've, you know, the kind of the closing of the loop with the space race and the Cold War with that first cooperation with the Russians. And Tom Stafford was the commander for that mission. And of course, Deke Slayton, one of the original Mercury 7, finally got to fly on that one. But it's interesting talking to General Stafford yesterday. At 88 years old, he said he had to go because he's in a room full of Russians and he's got to get them to sign some papers about the ISS. So he's still doing that stuff. It's just amazing.
He's sharp as a tack. We run into him on occasion, and he's looking 88, but he's got it all together still. So he's a great guy.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thanks for spending the time with us today on Blue Dot, on Contact Light, I should call it. And best of luck with the book, and enjoy all of the celebrations of the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 this summer. What are you going to do? Do you have any special plans for that?
Absolutely. We're going to be book signing out in D.C. at Airspace on July 20. And the next day we'll be over at Udvar-Hazy, the other Smithsonian facility in D.C. So I can't think of a better place to be on July 20 than at the National Air and Space Museum.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. And Columbia is there.
Well,
it's not quite yet.
It's not back yet?
It'll be out in Seattle.
Oh, darn.
They are bringing Armstrong's spacesuit out for the occasion. So it doesn't, they keep it locked up for the most part. It makes these rare appearances, and I think it goes on permanent display when they get their new Apollo area finished there at Air and Space. But that's not for
a couple of years
yet. Yeah.
Alrighty. Well, best of luck with that, and with the beautiful book picturing Apollo 11. J.L. Pickering and John Bisney, thanks so much for being with us on Blue Dot.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks again to our guests, John Bisney and J.L. Pickering. Their new book, Picturing Apollo 11 from the University of Florida Press, is available at most major booksellers. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. You can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org. Never miss an episode. Subscribe to us on NPR Podcasts via the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Blue Dot is distributed by PRX. Hey, that's the Public Radio Exchange. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz, and our producer engineer is Mr. Blue, Sky Schofield. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.